Welcome to the Enabled Disabled Podcast. I'm your host, Gustavo Serafini. I was born with a rare physical disability called PFFD. My journey has been about self-acceptance, persistence, and adaptation. On the show, we'll explore how people experience disability, how the stories we tell ourselves can both enable and disable, how vulnerability is the foundation for strength, and why people with disabilities can contribute more than we imagine. I hope that leaders, companies, clinicians, families, and friends will better understand our capacity to contribute to the world and help enable us to improve it. Mick Ebling is a force of nature. He's the founder of Not Impossible Labs and has been named one of the top 50 leaders in the U.S. by Forbes magazine. Mick and his team start with the absurdities of the world, kind of problems most people think are impossible. Then they get to work on solving it for one person at a time. Mick's ability to bring teams together to problem solve is remarkable. I've never met anyone like him, and I wanted to find out how he became such an amazing problem solver and talk about some of his most current work. If there's one takeaway I hope you have, it's this. The next time you're stuck, feeling like you'll never figure it out, please remember this episode. Nothing is impossible forever. If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a good rating on Apple, Spotify, or any whatever platform it is that you're listening to your podcast on. Thank you so much.
So Mick, welcome. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. I would love to start talking a little bit about Camus. You have a phenomenal quote on your website. The absurd is born between the human need and the unreasonable silence of the world. So are you a Camus fan? Do you read Camus, or did this quote just happen to resonate with you?
So that is the first time anyone has opened any conversation with me with a Camus quote. And I already can tell this is going to be a fun conversation. So I began my infatuation with Camus and French existentialism in college, where I think I just accidentally took a class. There was no preconceived kind of thought. I had transferred out of the Air Force Academy into UC Santa Barbara. So my priority was to just have as much fun as possible, take as easy classes as possible, because I had just come out of just the grill of and just the grind of the Air Force and a military education. And so I had this class, and it was called like French 303. And I read I took it, and it was French existentialism. And so I was had a deep dive with this old, disheveled, you know, he came in every day with a shirt that looked like he had pulled it out of the hamper. It was wrinkled. He, you know, I'm sure he spoke perfect. He was English, you know, he's American, but he spoke perfect French. And, you know, one of those things where he would, when someone knows French and then they look for opportunities to throw a French word in, but pronounce it perfectly, like that kind of personality. And he was this old guy. He was charming. And I remember just getting sucked into this class and it being like one of my favorite classes I've ever taken, right? I actually still kept all of my notes and all the books from it. And so that's when I was first exposed to Camus and Jean-Paul Sartre and other French existentialists. And the opening line for The Stranger, my mother died yesterday, or my brother died today, or was it yesterday, was this, my first kind of delving into this whole concept of nihilism and existentialism. And so full stop, I've always had kind of a passion around Camus. Fast forward to about a year or so ago, that quote was unearthed by my managing director, Adam Dole. And he showed that to me, and it was just like, ah, right? Because I was already a Camus fanboy. And that quote is just so representative of not only our sentiment at Non Impossible, but also we use the word absurd a lot. That's very much in our vernacular. And so Camus just nailed it once again. So that kind of restarted my Camus love affair.
Interesting. I mean, so I wasn't expecting that, but that's phenomenal. So you're a Camus fan. You dive deep into existentialism and nihilism, and yet you've taken this unbelievably optimistic view of it, right? Most people read Camus, Sartre, they either get depressed or they're just like, yeah, it's all absurd anyways. What, we can't do anything, right? It's just this absurd existence that we're just happen to be actors in this play. And you said, like, you know what? No, that's not my interpretation of it at all. When you come up against the absurd, we stand up and we do something about it.
Yeah, I think, you know, if a lot of my philosophy, I think, is the love child of a lot of different things that I have read or been exposed to over the years. And Ayn Rand, or Ayn Rind, depending on where your school of thought, had a book called The Virtue of Selfishness that I read after I had deep dived into The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Mm-hmm. And her political views aside, kind of, I think those stories of someone who just remains true to who they are really was inspiring to me. It's inspired lots of people. I'm not novel in that regard. But her Virtue of Selfishness was about this concept of the fact that selfishness and altruism are actually the reverse meanings. And to be selfish is to do things that make yourself feel good. And the act of doing good, the act of actually standing up for another human being, the act of putting yourself out there for the benefit of another person is actually the most selfish thing that you can do. Now, it's a play on semantics and words, but I think that's how I have taken my interpretation of existentialism and nihilism is if you're going to be here, why not do as much good as you can? Because that is essentially the most, you know, in Ayn Rand's opinion and in her book, the most selfish thing that you could do would be to serve other people.
And when did that thought like hit you for the first time where you said, you know what, I'm going to take this leap and I'm going to go do this? Like, when was that moment where it just happened, where it clicked?
I mean, I think it has been a progression of my upbringing by parents who are incredibly philanthropic. Jesuit education, I think, was incredibly influential on me. So I don't know if there was this moment where my mentality shifted. I do know the moment that Not Impossible was born, that concept, the philosophy of Not Impossible was born. But I think that this kind of who I am as a person has just been a general evolution.
Okay. But was there, and I think that's a great answer, that there was this process, but this sense of optimism that you have, this, you know, I'm calling it relentless optimism, because in the face of all these seemingly impossible challenges, you're just stepping up and doing something about it anyways. Was this cultivated by your parents growing up? Was this something that you also, it was part of your personality anyways? Like, how did this mix kind of evolve?
I think it's, you know, we are the grand sum total of our life's experiences. And I think that my childhood and the parents that I had, combined with the Jesuit education, combined with, I was sharing with someone the other day, I was in the Air Force for 2 years and I truly mastered the art of beating a system when I was in the Air Force, because I didn't want to abide by a lot of the rules. And so I figured out how to beat the system, and I actually I was really, really good at it until the very end, and then I got caught, and then I just got absolutely crushed at the end of my freshman year after they realized I had basically subverted their entire, you know, system of breaking people down and then building them up and making them learn things, and I had just beaten it. I think that taught me, like, wow, you can actually beat systems that are pretty rigorous and pretty entrenched. And what if you started to, you know, I think that kind of planted the seed of, like, what if you started to build systems, or what if you started to beat systems that oppressed people or status quos that kept people down in some capacity. So
you took that knowledge of how to do that, and what was the key moment from you that started Not Impossible Labs? Like, what was that moment of clarity that you said, you know what, my purpose has now shifted?
Are you familiar with the iWriter and the story of the iWriter?
I am.
So I was exposed to a paralyzed graffiti artist. His story stirred something up in me. I was appalled at the absurdity that this gentleman had been lying motionless in a bed for 7 years, unable to talk, unable to communicate, and it, without the access to the basic technology that other people with total paralysis had, because he didn't have the right health insurance and the right, you know, his parents didn't have the right income level. So I said, that's ridiculous, that's absurd, and ended up bringing a team together in this house, and people pushed the tables and chairs against the wall. We slept on the floors and hacked and programmed for about 2.5 weeks and came up with a device that was made of cheap sunglasses for the Venice Beach boardwalk, a coat hanger, zip ties, duct tape, and a web camera. And we wrote code so that he could put these glasses on, and by moving his eyes back and forth, the web camera would track the pupil of his eye, and that would move the cursor around the screen, and that would allow him to draw again. And so the act of doing that was kind of there was no strategy, there was no grand master plan, it was just, how can we help this one person? We did it, it worked, he drew again, everybody laughed, everybody cried, everybody went out to party and drink and celebrate afterwards, and then we all went home. And there was no preconceived strategy of what we would do with this afterwards, except for just make it better for Tempt, the artist. And then we woke up one day, and it was Time Magazine's top 50 inventions of the year, permanent collection at the MoMA, press and interviews and things from all over the world. And we went, whoa, 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 what just happened here? That wasn't what we expected. And that started this debate within myself of, like, should I continue doing this? Should I not continue doing this? And this meaning using technology to help people. And how do you use technology as a means to address problems in the world and then try to hack and make and create and program and convene brilliant people together to try to solve them? And I decided not to. After thinking and praying and sleeping on it, I decided not to. And I just said, I'm going to go back to my day job. I'll enjoy this Andy Warhol 15 minutes of fame, but I'm going to just ride this one out, but I'm going to go back to my day job. And then I got an email from the artist Tempt, and he said, that's the first time I'd drawn anything for 7 years. I feel like I've been held underwater, and someone finally reached out and pulled my head up so I could take a breath. And I mean, what do you do if you get an email like that and someone says something? So that, I, whenever I look back, that was the moment that Not Impossible Labs was born. That was the origin of Not Impossible Labs. We had no idea what we were going to do or how it was going to play out, but that was the moment that it was born.
Right. How can you not do it after that email, right?
Yeah.
So I'm really fascinated by, if we go back to the Temp story, right? You pulled this team together, and in 2.5 weeks, you innovated something incredible. What did that, like, in your mind, I know you have a background in production, like, how did you conceive of, like, who are we going to bring? How am I going to get these people here in time? How am I going to convince everybody to do it? And then what is that iteration process going to look like? You know, what was that, What was that like for you?
I mean, I think part of what we do well is we convene brilliant people together who are united around a common cause. And the common cause was, how do we help a paralyzed graffiti artist draw again? And then part of it is just creating the space for brilliance to happen and not futzing with it too much, right? So, I mean, part of my job was, and part of my job as a producer, is to bring people together, to convene people, to challenge people when they feel like they're stuck, to, you know, prod and poke. But it's, a lot of it's just get out of the way and let the brilliance take place. And then jump in when, you know, as paths are going down, to kind of bring it back over into it. So I kind of see myself in a lot of these things as the originator of the end goal and the idea. And then I just have to make sure that we get to that final outcome. But the in-between becomes more, you know, I just got to make a lot of pasta and have a lot of cold beer in the in-between to get us to that final place.
I think I'm sure there's much more to it than that, because clearly, so I mean, I don't say this to many people, like, I'm an entrepreneur. I never want to work for anybody. You're one of the first people that I have read about, seen, heard, who I would say, yep, you know, like, in a heartbeat, I would go work for Mick.
Wow, so, that's very kind of you.
You have the ability, and I see it with the Project Daniel story too, right? Where you brought in that carpenter who had made fingers for himself. And not only did he come help you, but he taught you everything that he knew about 3D printing. So you are inspiring a type of generosity in people. Like, I don't know what to call it, but you're inspiring a generosity in people that, to me, is astounding, that very few people have the ability to do. So I'm just trying to, you know, pick your brain. It's like, how are you doing this? What's the, you know, what's the, or maybe it's just you being you, but it's working and it's amazing.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I don't know how to, I'm honored that you would say something like that, and thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. You're very welcome. I think it's an incredible thing. I think your clarity of purpose is amazing. That idea of, you know, help one person, help many. And that seems to be happening with every project that you're taking on, right? It's just a consistent theme. How do you choose who you're helping?
I mean, the help one, help many becomes that unifier and that that focus for the team and what we do and how we do it. The selection of who we decide to help, it started off as completely generated internally. Like, the people who were working with me or a team, we would kind of come to those conclusions. Now what we've really tried to do is to try to expand that out and make it so that we've launched an initiative called, or a strategy couple years back called Non-Impossible by Others. And so we did a podcast, and then after the podcast we did the Non-Impossible Awards and the Non-Impossible. I mean, both of those were about celebrating other people who were making the impossible non-impossible. And then we launched a project called Absurdity Project. And Absurdity Projects, by the way, podcast, both the podcast and the Non-Impossible Awards, you can check out on our website at nonimpossible.com. So we did it this year. We had to go virtual. So we recorded that, and you can see that online. But then we launched these absurdity projects, which was about, how do you crowdsource things that A, are absurd, and B, have one person associated with that absurdity. So we would ask the question, what's absurd and who is your one? And in doing that, man, it just opened up the floodgates to this perspective on things that, you know, Gustavo knows what Gustavo knows. Faye knows what Faye knows. Mick knows what Mick knows. There's no judgment in that. It's just, I live in Venice Beach. Where are you, Gustavo?
South Florida. So Fort Lauderdale.
Okay, so you're in South Fort Lauderdale, Faye is in Boston or outside of Boston. So we know like what we see, what we're exposed to, the colors, the flavors, the smells, the sounds, that influences what affects us, right? Well, we are, that's, if you don't, if that's only what you're exposed to, then ultimately, if we only focus on the absurdities that we're solving, it's only going to be kind of a Southern California Venice Beach mentality. So when we started to reach out to other people and ask them what's absurd and who is your one, then all of a sudden the gloves came off. And that's how we got some of the, you know, the latest things that we've been working on, from Project Bishop to our initiative that we're working on around cognitive decline through traumatic brain injury or dementia or Alzheimer's. Like there's different things that kind of come into play that we wouldn't have contemplated had we not gone out and inquired and asked other people about that.
Interesting. Can you talk a little bit more about those latest projects? I'd like to learn more.
Sure. Project Bishop was one that we did in partnership with Zappos. Incredible guy there, by the name of Tyler Williams, who you guys should think about having on your show. He's an amazing human being. And he believes, he's a massive believer in what we do and how we do it. And he said, all right, let's launch an absurdity project here. Interviewed a bunch of people at the company after I gave a big speech at their all hands. People submitted ideas. We put them all on the table and picked some out, whittled it down, and eventually chose. There's a guy by the name of Javon who had a friend named Justin. And Justin and he grew up skating, and then Justin stopped coming around. And Justin was on a hard trajectory of possibly, you know, competing at the highest level. And Justin had retinitis, came down with or was struck down with retinitis pigmentosa. So he lost his vision. And that vision then, or the loss of vision, stopped him from skateboarding. And so the absurdity was, from Javon's perspective, was, I have a friend who loves the skateboard, who's incredibly good at it, but he can't do it because he lost his vision. And is there a way for us to empower him to get back out and to be able to compete again? And so we being from Venice Beach, I skateboard, my kids skateboard, you know, one of our pandemic projects this year was to build a half pipe in our backyard, you know, to kind of be able to bide our time during quarantine. And we decided to try to figure this one out. And so rinse and repeat, bring a bunch of people together, start to hack and program and figure out a way. And ultimately we crafted a way that was something that would be creating audio delineations and audio spaces that someone who can't see would be able to interpret and understand what their environment looked like or environment was by knowing, having audio cues around that space. And so that's what we created. We created these sound arrays that would send, that would have these kind of beeping noises. And those beeping noises were very focused. So they would just go down in a very confined amount of space, so that it's not like typically sound is like this and you can hear it anywhere. Well, when you put multiple speakers next to each other, this crazy thing happens where it focuses the sound, so it goes very straight. So if here's the sound and you're here, you can't hear it, but as you cross over it, you hear it. And so that would create those delineations around the space. So we did it, we took it to him, and he went bonkers, man. He went bonkers. He was, you know, he already was incredibly talented, but this kind of opened up his, you know, horizons of what he could do and what he could say. And for us, that's a wonderful, simple idea that we hope that these ideas, when people see them and experience them, that it empowers them, other people, to see them and go, wait a second, I would have never thought of that, but that's not that crazy of an idea. And where can I borrow that? Can I use that? Or what other things do I see in my life that are absurd, and how can I tackle them? We ultimately, that's kind of our goal at Not Impossible, is to be these people and this company that reminds people that they have the ability to do it. Not that it empowers them, or, you know, it's a semantics thing, but not to empower them or inspire them, but just to remind them that they have the ability to go do things, you know, and to go do incredible things.
That's so important. I mean, I remember visiting Brazil as a teenager, you know, São Paulo for the first time, and seeing the wealth, some of the wealthiest people there living, you know, right next to some of the, you know, the slums, the ghettos. And I remember being outraged as a teenager, saying like, how can you do this? This is crazy. And the people's response was, well, you know, this is what we live with. This is Brazil. And
yep.
I think your reminder is tremendously important that we don't have to settle for this. We don't have to accept it. We can actually do something about it. So this new project with the, it sounds like it was almost, I'm a techie person. So like, it's almost like it was sonar though, right? You use kind of like it's mapping his environment with audio.
Yeah. It's the reverse of sonar. Typically sonar is something that there's a primary or the origin person or entity will send something out and receive that information back. In this situation, we took the sonar or the sound cues and would put that in different places. And so people would pass through that.
How long did it take him to get used to it?
The wonderful thing about people who have lost their eyesight or lost their hearing or lost different abilities is they're able to adapt at like just superhuman speeds, adapt to different inputs or signals. And so it took him literally no time to be fluent in understanding kind of how to position things and really tried to push, you know, what we were doing to try to make it and refine it even more for his purpose.
That's incredible. That's absolutely incredible. How does your, like, I'm interested. I saw your Google Talks and you dived in a little bit into your business model there, but I find it interesting that you guys are essentially inventing all this amazing tech. You're giving the tech away essentially, right? Because I understand that that's what you believe. That's your mission. Mm-hmm. Have you guys thought about maybe shifting that a little bit and like maybe licensing it out for a very small fee that still incentivizes other people to go in and make it better, but it helps make you guys more sustainable by
What do you mean? What would we license out, do you think?
The idea, right? The idea that you've created something that hasn't existed before. You could patent it and you could license it.
Yeah, I mean, some of the things that we do, we will spin out, and we have spun out into their own separate, you know, businesses and P&Ls. But in certain things, we just feel like the obligation is to get it out there to as many people as possible. So, you know, in the case of Project Daniel, or in the case of the iWriter, we published that open source. And that was my first experience with open source. The team really educated me about that. But we published that open source with Project Daniel, the same thing. You know, we had that was a culmination of a lot of different factors, that a lot of different ideas that came into play. But we didn't think that the way to help the most amount of people was going to be by trying to, you know, launch a 3D printing prosthetic company. And I think that's the way that we think is we measure ourselves on how can we help the most amount of people first. And then we figure out can this be something that we can make money doing, you know? And so it's not a conventional business approach by any means, but it's what drives us and it's our purpose. So we have some that we give away and we have some that we have spun out into their own separate companies.
And when you give those away, how do you help make sure that it is helping as many people as possible? Do you keep your eyes on it?
Yeah, we keep our eyes on it. I mean, I wish there was a way to kind of tag it and drop a pixel on it so that we could figure out all the good that it's doing, but we're not able to, there's not a way to measure necessarily. And if there is, by all means, get in touch with me if you're listening to measure how you push something out into the open source community and then be able to track back whether your idea has really inspired people to go help others.
And did you always have this idea? I noticed like there's this hacker culture, hacker mentality. Was that something that was always paramount to bringing the team in? Like that just clicked with you? Like these are the people that at least need to be involved?
Yeah. I think there's this whatever it takes mentality that exists within the hacker maker culture that we just resonated with, you know? And I, again, would not consider myself to be a brilliant hacker or maker. I consider myself to be one, but I am in awe of kind of the abilities that people have of just like looking and pulling from different pots and pools and pans and putting it together and something works. And that's kind of our mentality of how we tackle the things that we do.
Interesting. So how can we help what you're doing? What are the biggest things that you're looking, how are you looking to grow? How are you looking to make more of an impact? What can we do to help you?
I mean, as of right now, we have a couple things that we have launched. One of the things that we've launched is an initiative right now that addresses hunger and food insecurity. In the wake of the pandemic, we saw that as one of the biggest problems and absurdities that our society is going to face. So you can find out more about that if you go to nonimpossible.com/hunger and see some of the things that we're doing there. If your community wants to help to promote that, if they want to donate a meal per week, a meal per month, you know, whatever they can do, we see that as just a super simple way for people to get involved. And we're pretty proud of the idea that we've created, and we think it really has the ability to scale. And then on a more of a large scale, kind of big picture perspective, you know, I think it's just about going out there and just going and helping people and believing that you can help people. You know, it doesn't have to be for us or with us, but seeing absurdities that you see in the world and saying, that's not right, it shouldn't be that way, and going out and doing something to try to solve it and fix it. I think that's, to me, is the way that we can subvert right now this culture of this culture of polarism that is just, you know, it's us versus them, it's red versus blue, it's, you know, whites versus Asians, or da, da, da. It's just like everything right now, like every news that you see is just about this, just it's about this lack of continuity within our species. And I just really believe that if there becomes more of this mentality of service where we just try to figure out how we can help our fellow man or woman, regardless of the color of their skin or who they sleep with or, you know, what they call themselves, it's like just that alone, I think, can propel our society forward. So, you know, if you want to support something pragmatic with Not Impossible, awesome. Come rock it with us on some of the things that we're working supports there. But on a bigger scale, like, I just think we have a bigger responsibility right now to be better citizens of this planet.
I agree with you completely. And one of the things that I think you're doing so right at Not Impossible is not only are you showing that commitment to service, but you're not doing it in a way that is critical of anybody else. You're just saying, look, this is what we're doing. This is how we're doing it. We're taking a stand. You know, come join us. You're actually inviting people. You're reminding people. You're not putting them down. You're not creating those conflicts. And I think it's beautiful. It's inspiring, and it's motivating. And I think you're hitting all the right chords.
Thank you.
You're welcome. How are we doing on time?
I think we could start to wrap it up. That'd be awesome.
Awesome. So last question that I would like to ask you, Mick, is there something that you want to talk about that I missed that you feel is important?
No, I mean, I think we got a chance to talk about many of the things that we're working on now and kind of our ideals and our position on the planet and the specifically right now our position on hunger. Like, that's the thing that I always like to try and talk to people about, is this this with what we're working on right now is this concept of what would happen if we created a level of stability where everybody who was food insecure was no longer food insecure, that they knew where their next meal was coming from. What could that do to our society? Because if you think about that need that you have when you're hungry and you get grouchy and angry and just a horrible person to hang out with, and you're just a couple hours after your meal time, imagine having to go to bed to deal with your hunger. Like you have to just sleep it off because you hope that your fatigue, it overcomes the pit in your stomach without eating. Think about when people are constantly worried about that, you know, what their perspective is in the world. It's hard for them to have a perspective that's much beyond 3-4 hours, right? And so there was an incredible playwright named Bertolt Brecht, and he had a saying that was now is kind of a battle cry for us at Non Impossible, and specifically in regards to our hunger initiative, which is food first, then morality, right?
Yeah.
So you can't think about anything else unless you've been fed, right? So don't talk to me about going to school. Don't talk to me about going to get a job, or don't talk to me about stopping doing drugs or anything like that. Don't talk to me about anything until there's food in my belly. So that's why we're really proud of what we've done. We just crossed over 100,000 meals since we launched in April. 3 days before that, we got our first 1 million meal order out of that we'll be serving in Chicago through this. Wow. And it's all, we have another 500,000 meals we're doing in Santa Monica now. And it all came through text messaging. Like where everything happens with it's called Bento is the company that we spun off. It all happens through texting. So we're not asking anybody to change any of their behaviors or download a new app or go wait in a line for 4 hours waiting for a box of food that you don't know what's going to be in it. It all deploys people geo-conveniently to restaurants that are close to them. So Gustavo or Mick, who are food insecure, we don't have to take a bus across town or borrow a car, drive across town to wait in line. We actually have the ability to go to restaurants that are very close and proximate to us to go pick up a meal. And all the ordering process happens on the back end, and you do it real time, so there's no waste. So Gustavo enters hungry. It starts a text prompt. It ask you what your address is so we can manually geolocate you, because many of these people don't have a big fat data plan. Then we offer you restaurants that are close to you. You pick the restaurant, then you pick the food, and then you go in and pick it up. And so
these are restaurants that they have extra food that they're going to get rid of.
It's not extra food. The food's actually paid for from the nonprofit or the charity that supports that person. So we give the software away to the nonprofit, to the community-based organization, to the church, to the school. And then they just pour the cell phone numbers in of their constituents. And that's the thing. Everybody has a cell phone, right? Like 96% of the country has a cell phone. The 4% are probably people who are, you know, on life support someplace, because that's how prevalent it is. So they're either at the end of their life or they're so young that they don't even know what a cell phone is, right? That's probably the 4%. So once people are enrolled in this program, they are able to kind of dial up and eat at a convenience level and a frequency that they have with the organization, the Boys and Girls Club or the City of Santa Monica or whoever it may be. I can't tell you that how simple that is for an organization to deploy, and everybody along the continuum from the organization that's deploying it now doesn't have to do anything except for enter cell phone numbers into the application. Restaurants, local restaurants now get business where they wouldn't have got it otherwise. Now that those meals are eventually going to be discounted, but they're still getting business coming in the door. And then the person, you know, the Gustavo or the Mick who comes in, we come in with just like anybody else. We just walk in and grab our meal and, hi, my name is Mick. Here you go, Mick. Give me my meal. And I walk out, so I get to walk out with dignity. So that program for us is so important because of not just the simplicity of what it does and the frictionless nature of how it does it, but we just see this as a way that we might be able to really stabilize this bottom line, baseline Maslow hierarchy of need that could give our society the ability to think about what's next as opposed to what's next in, you know, 2-3 hours from now.
That's incredible. I mean, you're taking a problem you know, by the horns with innovation, and you're saying like, this problem has been with us for a long time and it's getting worse. And you guys are just like, look, it's solvable. Here it is. And let's just do it. So who do we, if I want to go and start pitching that down here, or, you know, a listener in another city that doesn't have that program yet, what are the first steps that we should be taking?
It's super simple. If there's an organization that has a constituency of people that need to be fed, Boys and Girls Club, YMCA,
local church,
local church, whatever it might be, all they have to do is connect. They just say, great, we've got the money to pay for the meals. They get in touch with us. We deploy the program with them. All that has to happen is they enter the cell phone numbers of the people into the program, and then boom, they start. I mean, if someone was to call me right now and say, hey, we want to launch this in Fort Lauderdale, we want to launch this in Boston, we want to launch whatever. And our primary markets were in Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Dallas, Houston, San Francisco, Oakland, Seattle. If you live in one of those cities, then we're already live and working there. So it's a question of just having the money to fund the meals. And that's quite frankly, that's the easy part.